Okay, so the only problem with this is I tend to be animated, so I like to use both my hands. But it's a great opportunity for us to be able to be with you this morning with the World Mission Communications team. For me, I just got back after 3 weeks of being out in the bush in Papua New Guinea and in Australia, and it's nice to have dry feet. I've got some pictures of being in mud up to my knees for about 7 days. The only time I had dry feet was when we laid down at night and took our shoes off. And the next morning we'd hose them off or wipe them off or put them in the river to try and get the mud off, put them back on and go again. So it's nice to actually have dry feet. It's also nice to be able to come and share with you guys this morning. I'd like to start out with a story for you. And it's a story from years past. I went to the mission field, Connie and I did, when we were 24 and 25 years old. I won't tell you which one was 24 and which one was 25. I might get beat up at the end. But we started out in the Micronesian Islands, and we were pilots flying for a medical mission. And so what we would do is do medical evacuations and emergency airlifts. And on a particular day in the spring, trade winds had started to die down. There was this air about the island that day. It was a time when the winds had started to drop, and many of you know who have grown up in Asia or grown up in the Pacific Islands that you can sense when something is in the air, can't you, when there's a change coming. And I knew after having lived in the islands for a while that it meant that a storm was building, that there was most likely a typhoon on the horizon. And sure enough, as I checked on the HF radio and called out to stations, I found out that several hundred miles south of our station in Yap in Micronesia, there was a storm that was building, a tropical storm that would later become a typhoon. And just a few hours later, I got a call, came into the phone at our mission base, and it said, we have 3 children, 2 teachers. They set out in a boat from the island of Wulyai, and they were going to an island that was about 30 miles away. They set out in the late night, and I'm not sure why they did, but they started out about 9 o'clock at night. They were going to go through the darkness and arrive the following morning at the island. Well, they never arrived. As the storms started to build, the clouds started to build, they were concerned that they had never arrived. And so they called our base and they said, is there any way you could come out and start to search for them? Well, we did a quick check of what the weather was showing, and I said, well, we have very limited time. We'll fuel up the airplane. We'll fly about 200 miles to the closest airstrip. And so we did. We loaded up fuel drums, and we flew to the closest airstrip. We landed, and I picked up 10 Micronesian Islanders, 5 down each side of the airplane, so they could look out the windows and search. We put fuel in the airplane that I had hauled down in drums. We got everything ready, and then I laid a chart out on the wing of the airplane. And I called together some of the local islanders, and I said, okay, based on my knowledge of winds, I think that maybe they could have drifted here, or they could have drifted south maybe, but I need to know what your knowledge of the ocean currents are. And I asked them, what could you tell me? And we got together our heads, and we said, well, maybe they started from this island, and they quit somewhere, or maybe they overshot, but we think that we should go out, and we should fly this square. I said, well, we better know well, because we've only got about 4 hours of time to search. And so we went out into this square that we diagrammed on our charts, and we started flying at about 400 feet off the ocean. The wind was starting to pick up, seas were starting to get rough, and we looked for hour after hour out the windows, almost 3 hours, trying to find that one white cap that wouldn't go away, because the boats that they used, it was only about a 15-foot outboard boat. White on the outside, blue on the inside. I'm not sure why they paint them that way, because in the ocean they don't show up very well. They just look like a white cap. And so we continued to fly, and we looked, and 3 hours had gone by, and by now the sun was starting to set. It was getting dark, and I was starting to become very discouraged in the cockpit. And I was saying, Lord, where could they be? All of a sudden, I started to pray a little bit differently. My prayer was, Lord, this is so far beyond me. I have no idea where in the ocean these people could be, but you are the creator of this ocean. Give me inspiration. Give me an idea of where to go to search for them. Suddenly, and I can't explain where it came from, I got this idea. I can tell you where it did come from. God had intervened. But I got this idea, and it was whole numbers. Now, if you know anything about ocean currents and aviation, things don't happen in whole numbers. There's fractions and an eighth and a tenth. But I said, okay, if they broke down in their boat somewhere between Woolly Eye, where they departed, and the island here, let's say that they did that when they first went missing. That would be 20 hours ago now. And let's just say that they drifted at 2 miles per hour. Again, with the ocean currents and the winds, that would be highly unlikely. But let's just say they drifted at 2 miles per hour. 2 miles per hour times 20 hours missing would be 40 hours or 40 miles. And I took my chart, I laid it across, and I drew a line down from the island they started, Woolly Eye, and I drew a line down from the island where they should be going that went with the direction of the wind. And I went down 40 miles, and I drew another straight line. And I turned the airplane, and I started to fly for that line. Do you understand how crazy that would be? The other people in the airplane who had done sea searches with me told me how crazy that was. They said, what are you doing? You're leaving the search area. I said, I can't explain it, but I believe God has directed me to leave this search area and to go down to this 40-mile line and fly it. It will be the last line we get to fly, because by then darkness will hit and we'll have to return. The storm was starting to pick up so bad that at 500 feet we were getting wind-whipped spray off of the ocean. I had the windshield wipers going on the airplane. I got down to the 40-mile line and I turned and I started to fly west along that line, searching, looking in the darkness of the ocean now. We got to the end of that 40-mile line, and we had seen nothing. And let me tell you, my soul was in agony. I thought I had heard from God. I thought we had flown that line. What had happened? You know, there's a story in the Bible very similar to this story. Similar circumstances. It's the story of Gideon. And I want to bring you up to speed to where we find Gideon in Judges chapter 6. Because you see, Gideon was living in a time when things weren't going so well for the children of Israel. In fact, if we look back at the history, the children of Israel have fled Egypt at this point in time. They have come to the Red Sea. They've seen God do incredible things, right? He has led them by a pillar of fire by night, and a cloud by day. They have seen manna. They have seen incredible things. They've seen Moses lead them and provide through God incredible miracles, right? They've crossed the Jordan at this point. So as we look at the history, they've done all these great things. They're now in the Promised Land, but things have gone south for them. Why? Because they didn't follow what God had told them to do. They made some mistakes. But we find Gideon now because the Midianites have come up against him. We find Gideon in this story in chapter 6 in a wine press, and he's thrashing out the wheat. Why? Because the forces have come up against him. And I want us to turn in our Bibles now to chapter 6 of Judges. Chapter 6, verse 11, we'll start. So Gideon is there. He's in the wine press. He's hiding because the folks have come up against him in a pretty hard way. I'm going to actually start in verse 1 of chapter 6. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and for 7 years he gave them into the hands of the Midianites. Because of the power of Midian was so oppressive, the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts, caves, and strongholds. Whenever the Israelites planted crops, the Midianites, Amalekites, and other eastern peoples invaded the country. They camped on the land and ruined the crops all the way to Gaza and did not spare a living thing for Israel, neither sheep nor cattle nor donkeys. They came up with their livestock and their tents like swarms of locusts. It was impossible to count the men and their camels. They invaded the land to ravage it. Midian so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to the Lord for help. When the Israelites cried to the Lord because of Midian, he sent them a prophet who said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. I snatched you from the power of Egypt and from the hand of all your oppressors. I drove them from before you and gave you their land. I said to you, 'I am the Lord your God. Do not worship the God of the Amorites in whose land you live.' But you have not listened to me." And now we come to the story of Gideon. verse 11. The angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak in Ophrah that belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites. When the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." "But sir," Gideon replied, "if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our fathers told us about when they said, 'Did not the Lord bring us out of Egypt?' But now the Lord has abandoned us and put us into the land of Midian." The Lord turned to him and said, "Go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you?" "But Lord," Gideon asked, "how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family." The Lord answered, "I will be with you, and you will strike down all the Midianites together." Turn over with me now, and we're going to pick up the story again in chapter 7. Early in the morning, Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all his men camped at the spring of Herod. The camp of Midian was north of them in the valley near the hill of Moreh. The Lord said to Gideon, "You have too many men for me to deliver Midian into their hands, in order that Israel may boast against me that her own strength has saved her. Announce now to the people, anyone who trembles with fear may turn back and leave Mount Gilead." So 22,000 men left, while 10,000 remained. But the Lord said to Gideon, "There are still too many men. Take them down to the water, and I will sift them for you there. If I say there, this one shall go with you, he shall go. But if I say this one shall not go with you, he shall not go." So Gideon took the men down to the water. There the Lord told him, "Separate those who lap the water with their tongues, like a dog, from those who kneel down to drink." 300 men lapped with their hands to their mouths. All the rest got down on their knees to drink. The Lord said to Gideon, "With the 300 men that lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hands. Let all the other men go, each to his own place." So Gideon sent the rest of the Israelites to their tents, but kept the 300 who took over the provisions and the trumpets of the others. We know how this story goes. We know that God worked in incredible ways on behalf of the children of Israel. We also know that God worked through Gideon. And I went back and I was studying Gideon and I was saying, you know, who was this Gideon guy? Some of the points that I came across were this, that Gideon was not a tremendous warrior at this point in time. You know, oftentimes we see that the wisdom of God is foolishness to the world. In fact, I'm amazed at how many times God goes in and takes something that seems insignificant, someone who seems insignificant, and turns them in to yet a mighty warrior. And we think of Gideon. He wasn't that brave at this point in time. He was in the wine press. He was in there hiding, trying to take care of business when God called on him. You know, if you were to get a book, I like that book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. You probably wouldn't see any books talking about Gideon that says, this is the way to win battles. Take the man who has no military strategy and have him lead the people, and this is how you're going to go conquer, and this is how you're going to win. No, you probably wouldn't find a book that way, but God took Gideon because Gideon was willing. He came and he called him. Gideon was a little bit afraid, and if we go back and we look at the rest of the story and we see the fleece that he set out, I'm not sure that's tremendous theology, but God worked with Gideon. Gideon wanted to find out if this was really where God was calling him to go. God spoke to him, gave him a vision, and then said, "Go, am I not with you?" One of the other points I want to bring out is often when God calls us to go, he asks us to do something first. If we look in Gideon back in chapter 6, verse 25, after God had called Gideon, he said, that same night the Lord said to him, "Take the second bull from your father's herd, the one 7 years old. Tear down your father's altar to Baal. Cut down the Asherah pole beside it. Then build a proper kind of altar to the Lord your God on the top of this height. Using the wood of the Asherah pole that you cut down, offer the second bull as a burnt offering." So Gideon took 10 of his servants and did as the Lord told him, but because he was afraid of his family and the men of the town, he did it at night rather than in the daytime. In the morning, when the men of the town got up, there was Baal's altar demolished and the Asherah pole beside it cut down and the second bull sacrificed on the newly built altar. They asked each other, who did this? When they carefully investigated, they were told, Gideon, son of Joash, did it. The men of the town demanded Joash, bring out your son, he must die, because he was broken down Baal's altar and cut down the Asherah pole beside it. But Joash replied to the hostile crowd around him, are you going to plead Baal's case? Are you trying to save him? Whoever fights for him shall be put to death by morning. If Baal really is a god, he can defend himself when someone breaks down his altar. So that day they called Gideon, Jerubbaal, saying, let Baal contend with him because he broke down Baal's altar. So God had called Gideon, told him he was going to go out and deliver the children of Israel. What I found in my own life, and really this is my journey, is when God calls us to go out and do something, he often asks us to take a first step of obedience. And many times that's cleaning out our own house. And can you imagine, put yourself into Gideon's place for just a moment. God didn't ask him to immediately go out and attack the enemies. Where did he start? He asked him to go to his father's house. Can you imagine what that would have been like? As I was traveling in Australia, I met some folks from Iraq, Kirkuk, and I found some young people who had come to know Christ in the middle of a Muslim-controlled area. And when God moved in their lives, he so impacted them that they said, regardless of what it means, regardless of the dangers for my life, I'm going to step out. One of those young men went to his father and told his father right off the bat, this is what God has told me to do. His father was furious. And in fact, the uncle is an imam. And when he found out, the dad, what this young man was going to do, he was so furious, he says, if you come around, we will kill you. I won't kill you, but your uncle will. And the young man had to flee. Can you imagine Gideon? Gideon has been told to start out at home, to cut down the idols, to destroy the things that are against God, to clean house at home. I had a spiritual mentor that once told me years ago, he said, when God calls you to move, and you're wondering if it's his will, step forward in obedience in those small things when he asks you to. And if you're feeling away from God and you feel like you're not hearing from him, go back to that first thing that God told you to do, the last thing you can remember, and do it. Because often God is asking us to step out first in faith and obedience before he gives us the rest of the picture. And so this is what God did, I believe, for Gideon. He gave him the first step. He didn't show him the whole picture. He didn't show him how everything was going to turn out. He gave him the first step, and he said, step forward in obedience right here at home, and then I'll give you the rest of the picture. And Gideon did. He stepped out. The third thing I'd like us to look at is that God is God, and we are not. And how many times do we struggle with that concept? I know I do. I'm preaching to myself here. How many times do I look at the program that I think I'm building up or the vision I think God has given me? And can you imagine putting yourself into Gideon's place again? Can you imagine what that was like when God said, you've got too many men? We read here that the Midianites, when they were encamped against them, that their camels and the people were like swarms of locusts. They were innumerable. Can you imagine looking out on that? And then having God tell you, you've got too many men, you know, 32,000. I'd be going, God, 32, that's not a lot. That's, you know, I need some help here. And God says, no, 32,000, that's too much. Let's drop it down a little bit. So God takes 22,000 away and gives me 10,000 left. Okay, that's cool. All right, God, with you and me and 10,000, we can take on the world. And he says, no, sorry, that's too many. Why? Because God wanted to prove that I am God, and Gideon, you are not. Children of Israel, when I act, it's going to be the power of God, and you're going to be able to stand back, and no one is going to be able to say it's because of your wisdom that you accomplished this, but it's through me. And so that's what happened. We drop them back, and now we've got 300. If I was Gideon, I would be looking for more than a fleece at this point in time. Because now put yourself in Gideon's shoes again. I always like to go back and try and understand what they were feeling. He is going out to lead his army with 300 against innumerable camels and people and parked like locusts on the horizon everywhere. And it's not just choosing a new religion. It's not just deciding to become a pastor. It's not deciding to leave your home and follow a call of God. He's putting his life on the line, right? He's going to lead the charge. And if God isn't with him at this point in time, it's going to get pretty messy pretty quick. But Gideon, again, was willing to step forward. God is God. We are not. And then the last thing is the battle is not ours. It is God's. You know, that brings an incredible liberating or freeing experience for me. It's taken me a lot of years to understand that. Because I've always thought, as a new young missionary, I thought it was up to me to go out and be the salesman. I have to go out and share this word. I have to share the gospel. I have to be the one that tries to convince someone to come to a personal knowledge of Christ. And so that would sometimes intimidate me. Because how is my presentation going to be? Do I have all the fundamentals down? What are they going to say? But you know what God has been speaking to me is, it's not your battle. I'm asking you to be an instrument. I'm asking you to be the person I can flow through. Connie and I had a very unique experience this last fall in September. Was it September? Was it MST? October? We had the opportunity to go to Singapore for the mission strategy training. And in Singapore, we were focusing on the approach of taking the gospel into the Islamic community, into sharing the camel book, and how to draw bridges between the Quran and the Bible, how to share non-offensively with someone who was of Islamic faith. And so we were reading all of this, and the big focus was the person of peace. And the whole person of peace concept is that God is already working in the hearts of people. God is calling them to himself. He is asking us to go and just be his instruments and to find that person of peace that God is already working in. Connie and I were reading this, and I was saying, you know, this is almost too good to be true, because it takes the pressure off of us. We just need to be praying that God will give us spiritual eyes, that he will allow us to see what he is seeing and to work with the people whose hearts he is already preparing. And so we prayed, we said, God, if this is really where you're working, make it clear to us, show us. And so we went down on Arab Street in Singapore, where you're not allowed to proclaim the gospel. You're not allowed to go out and evangelize. In fact, if you do, you have the very likely possibility that you will be given a prison ministry from the inside out. You understand what that means? That means you get arrested, you go to jail, you get to have a prison ministry from the inside out. And so they cautioned us to be very careful about going and proclaiming the gospel on Arab Street, but to just go and to talk. Well, we went down, and I was saying, Lord, if this is where you're working, give us that person of peace. And so we saw one man along the street who was playing with some dogs, and his wife was getting in a car and stuff like that. And we walked up, and I was thinking, this might be the person of peace. And it wasn't. We sort of said some words, and we turned and we went along, and Connie looked to the right, and there was a rug store that was selling these great rugs and material, you know, and so I think we lost our focus from person of peace to shopping. And it happens from time to time, because, you know, so we sort of lost that focus a minute, and we turned and went into the carpet store. And isn't it just like God to show up when you least expect it? You know, I bet Gideon, when he was thrashing out the wheat, didn't expect God to show up there and the angel of the Lord to speak to him. And a man was sitting there on a stool. He was the shop owner. And as Connie went to look at this carpet, I turned to this man on the stool, and God opened up an incredible opportunity with a person of peace. And for about the next hour and a half, Connie and I shared with this young man and listened to him, and it was just like the book had been written right there on the street. He apologized for the radical attacks against Christians perpetrated by Muslims. And we said, you know, we apologize for the fact that so many of us Christians profess one thing and live out something else, and call into question what it is like to follow Jesus Christ. And the conversation was, he said, you know, I believe in this. Jesus was a great prophet. And it was amazing how God worked. We now have his email address, contact information. God ordained that moment of a person of peace. He was already working. He just wanted us to have eyes to see, to be spiritually awake to what was happening around us. At World Mission Communications, we've been really focusing for the last several months. My team is probably tired of hearing me say it. I've been saying it over and over and over, and that is, let's find out where God is working and join him. So many times, we dream up a great project. We dream up a great new idea, and we say, let's go do it, and oh, by the way, God, will you bless it? How many meetings have you been in? How many board meetings have you sat through? Or how many conference or committee meetings have you been on where we sit down and as a token at the beginning, we say, God bless what we're going to do, or bless the action we've already taken, and then we go on our way. God has really been speaking to me to start my days with a plan, but then give him all of the diversions and distractions throughout the day and give him the authority, turn it over to him and allow him to direct me throughout the day to see every one of the distractions and diversions as something that he is ordaining, to follow him, to look for where he is working and to join him. As I was sitting in the cockpit of that plane and we had reached the end of this 30-mile line, it was now dark. I was agonized. I thought for sure I had heard God speaking. I thought for sure he had given me wisdom beyond myself. I knew now with the fuel gauges where they were on the airplane that I had about 20 minutes reserve fuel. I would have to turn, head back to the island, put whatever fuel I had left on the island and get the plane out of there before this typhoon hit, because if the typhoon hit while the plane was still on the island, it would be destroyed. And I knew that at the end of this line, having not found those people, that those three kids and those two teachers would perish. There's no way they could survive a typhoon in an outboard 15-foot boat in the middle of the Pacific. And you can imagine the agony. I'm at the end of that line, and I'm a little bit tenacious. And instead of turning to the right, because I would have turned and gone back to refuel at the island, I said, I'm going to turn 270 degrees in pilot talk, because that would bring me back around through the search area one more time. And I made that turn. It's now dark. There's no way I can see anything in the ocean. And as I make that turn at 500 feet above the ocean, windshield wipers on, spray on the aircraft, as I cross the line between the two islands, turning to go back, I see this little light down in the ocean. We had flown right over the top of them, so much over the top of them that they had gone right down the center of the aircraft underneath and we couldn't see because of the windows. God had taken us right over the top of them. But it happened at the moment where I said, I'm giving up my plan. I am not God. I don't have the knowledge here. God has to do something. And when I turned it over to him, it did not make sense. It was counter to the wisdom of search patterns. It was counter to everything I had been taught about how to have a successful search. You don't break the search area and go randomly to some place and start searching again. But God wanted to show something. God wanted to show that he was God. I was not. And he would receive all the glory for the finding of those people. If you think about the oceans and the size of the Pacific Ocean, the likelihood that we would fly right over the top of them is millions to one. But God, when God is in control, it only takes 300 against hundreds and thousands, doesn't it? I'll tell you, it's liberating. And I want to challenge us this morning to look deep in our hearts and to find out, where is God working? A lot of us are called to ministry. We wouldn't be here at APNTS if we weren't. We're called to some area of ministry.